Imagine earning a degree that prepares you with real skills for the real world. Capella University's programs teach skills relevant to your career, so you can apply what you learn right away. Learn how Capella can make a difference in your life at capella.edu.
You heard you could save big when you bundle home and auto with Progressive, so you went online to check it out. But then you saw a link for a survey about which type of bread you are. And now you're on question 17, barely scratching the surface of your bread identity. You always thought of yourself as a brioche, but are you actually more of a pumpernickel? Ah, yes. They said it was easy to save money bundling with Progressive, but they forgot about the rest of the internet. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company affiliates and other insurers. Bundle discount not available in all states or situations.
HD Smartcast.
You are listening to a Mint production brought to you by HD Smartcast.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of Capital Calculus, the show which focuses on the intersection of politics and economics, something that is critical in democracies like India, especially in influencing what the little guy gets or does not get. Every week, this show will explore this intersection to try and give you a fresh perspective on the week that was. I am your host, Anil Padmanabhan. New numbers show the Indian economy is recovering, slowly though, and unevenly at that. Further, the revival is occurring mostly in sectors like automobiles, real estate and consumer durables, most of which reflect the consumption pattern of the top income percentile of the population. But what about those at the bottom of the pyramid? Unfortunately, for now, the recovery is eluding them. Yet, theirs is not a story often told. Yes, fleeing migrants did briefly put the spotlight on their fate, but that was just the tip of the iceberg. In the last 7 months, many have fallen back into poverty, swelling the ranks of the new poor. Worse, many have had to liquidate their assets. 10.4 million salaried workers have dipped into their retirement savings so far, withdrawing nearly Rs 40,000 crore in 5 months. How will all this stack up, especially with respect to inequality? Exactly why I spoke to Beena Agarwal. She is the former director of the Institute of Economic Growth. At present, she is a professor of development economics and environment at the University of Manchester and a domain expert on inequality. I began by asking her about who bore the brunt of this unprecedented economic shock.
Well, in this pandemic has been so wide-ranging that a vast number of people have been impacted. Firstly, those who have lost jobs. So if you take the migrant workers returned home during the lockdown, there's been huge amounts of landlessness. Secondly, women have been impacted. And third, children who now have to stay at home and catch up with their studies without the necessary means for that. And all of these categories would be already people who are in a precarious situation economically, even prior to the pandemic.
Obvious question then. Will the migrants get back their jobs soon?
Well, we have some interesting analysis that was done recently. I saw a paper by Ashwini Deshpande, and she looked at CMIE data, which they have been doing longitudinal studies. And they looked at the situation in April and found that it had hugely reduced employment, both for men and women. And now, in August, there has been a degree of recovery, particularly for men, much less for women. But the recovery has simply been in terms of now they say they are reporting themselves as employed. What it doesn't capture is what is the intensity of work and what are the earnings. So simply saying that we have recovered in employment will not mean that in terms of their ability to be food secure or in otherwise secure is guaranteed.
Presumably, this would have increased the number of new poor. I asked Beena if she agreed.
Absolutely. I mean, firstly, we have broad estimates which show that many, many millions more will join the ranks of the extreme poverty. And as you know, large numbers of our poor in any case hover around the poverty line. So if there's any kind of crisis, not even a pandemic, but suppose you have a person in the household who falls ill, you slip below the poverty line. And this has impacted on a much larger scale entire families. So I expect there to be huge increases in poverty. Now, you know, when people say, will they recover? I think the concept of resilience is very important because there are people who might get back their jobs to an extent. Some of the self-employed may get back to work, but there will be large numbers of enterprises and the workers who work on those enterprises, which would have been crippled and will not have the resilience to come back.
So in that case, the scarring can be potentially permanent for some segments of those at the bottom of the pyramid?
We know of the concept of the working poor. So if you're poor, you can't afford not to work. And the numbers of the working poor are likely to increase. Because unless the economy picks up and jobs increase, you're just going to have more and more people who will be working for an hour or two. Even if you take something like NREGA, and I was looking at the figures, the total number of work days haven't picked up to the last years. Although we know that many of the people who had returned as migrants, as well as those who are rural households who need jobs, have been using NREGA. What's also interesting and important to recognize is that there could be a crowding out. So, for instance, it is one of the most important sources of employment, guaranteed employment for women in poor households. And what I'm looking at the figures recently, I found that if you look at 1920 and 2021, the proportion of total work days, women's work days, has gone down. Now, this seems to suggest that there is crowding out, even in NREGA jobs.
What about the cohort of women? How have they borne this economic shock?
You know, when much of the discussion around the impact on women has been on the increase in care work, the domestic work burdens, because you have more members in the household, and on domestic violence. But I believe we have to look at women's livelihoods much more closely. And there are direct effects of a loss of livelihood and there are indirect effects. So, for instance, the direct effect would be that you lose your earnings. There's been a lot of focus recently on domestic helps and how they have large numbers of them were had no longer any employment immediately after the shutdown. And even now, many of them have not been hired back. But women also work in construction, in urban areas, and in a variety of other services. In rural areas, they work primarily in agriculture. So 75% of rural women workers are in agriculture, much more dependent on agriculture than are men. Now, we don't have a clear sense. I know agriculture has done relatively better than any other sector. As you know, the green shoot was agriculture in the first quarter grew at 3.4%, whereas the economy contracted by 23.9%. What you do have is the couple of actually good surveys which have gone beyond employment and livelihood and jobs to look at the indirect effects. And the indirect effects have been in rural areas, for instance, if you have returned migrants, those households where the migrants return, the women are spending much more time fetching firewood and fodder in rural India. And you also have reports of food scarcity. Now, knowing that there are inequalities within the home in terms of intra-household sharing of food, where women eat last and least, and also girl children, we would expect that hunger is unequally shared within the home.
Equally worrying is the impact on children. The pandemic has forced schools to shut down. Students are now relying on online classes. This is exactly the rub. Not all students have online access. The just released Annual Status of Education report, or ASER, makes a startling revelation. It shows that only little under a third of India's school children are accessing online education. Even fewer are able to take live online classes. What does this digital divide do to learning opportunities? I ask Beena.
I think there are two issues here which are very important. One is that as you also find in the ASER report that there is a much lower enrollment. There's been a decline in enrollment, both for girls and boys, but particularly for girls. And this is across different age groups. So for me, that itself is extremely bothersome. That there are children are not enrolling, but also that they're not enrolling not just at the primary stage level, but at multiple levels. And secondly, as you point out, the digital divide is about internet access. It's there is one divide which is just about who has mobile phones and not. And on that, perhaps the differences, there are still differences. I was looking at some figures. This was about, again, about gender, but 50%, if they looked at rural and urban adults, 2,000 of them in 2019, and found that 63% of women, 73% of men had mobile access. But mobile internet, 21% of the women, 42% of the men. Now, obviously, children in richer homes will have their own mobile sets with internet. But in poor households, they might just have one mobile phone. And even if that has an internet, and you have more than one child, then one or two of those children will suffer. And of course, as you know, this has long-term implications because a one-year gap, a child in a rich home may be able to catch up on. But a one-year gap in poor households where it is still very difficult to keep children in school at upper levels can be quite devastating.
Is it fair to surmise that inequality in the economy would have worsened in this period?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, already pre-pandemic, we know that there's been huge inequalities in terms of the proportion of people who own most of the country's wealth and earn most of the country's income. So if you add to that, that large numbers of people don't have employment, even if they manage to come back to some semblance of employment, they're not earning very much. Poverty and inequality can't be separated quite in this context, because if you, as you mentioned, if there is a whole category of new people who are poor, then they're also part of the segment which is at the bottom of the pyramid. So inequality is also simultaneously increased.
To cushion the economic shock, people have started to dip into their savings, jeopardizing their future.
Assets, I think, have a particular meaning in the pandemic. So one of the things that you notice, suppose there's a crisis, and I've looked at, for instance, context of seasonal, if there's a drought or a famine-like situation, how do people draw upon their assets? Now, those who have large assets may be able to survive. Those who have rather few assets might be able to mortgage them. So land is a very good example that people tend not to either sell or mortgage out their land. The first thing that goes is large animals, sometimes women's jewelry. And there are reports now of people selling their mobile phone. The kind of asset you have to sell in a pandemic like this matters. If you sell your tools of trade, so suppose you are a vegetable vendor and you have to sell your cart, then you're not going to be able to be resilient enough to bounce back. So I think we need to think of asset ownership in a whole range of ways, of those who are cushioned fully, those who are cushioned partially because they have some assets that they can trade, and those who have absolutely no assets. And there are huge numbers of reports of people drawing on their savings, even provident funds. I mean, you have low middle class people drawing on their provident funds. So if they draw seriously on their savings, it has long-term implications because those savings were a kind of cushion for the future, which no longer exists.
How do we then return people to their livelihoods?
I feel that we need to really think outside the box here. Because we tend to normally think of people in jobs as atomized individuals, X number of people. What I found very interesting, you know, I've been working on issues of collectives in rural India, and especially group farming. You know, the idea of group farming being that our farmers, as you know, are mostly very small. 86% of our farmers cultivate less than 2 hectares. And many of them are non-viable. So I actually looked at cases where farmers pooled their land, labor, and capital to move from very tiny plots to a larger piece of land on which they could have economies of scale and so on. And interestingly, and Kudum Shri in Kerala is a very good example. It has 68,000 group farms, you know, with women of between anything between 4 to 10 women coming together and farming. I think about 50,000 plus who was farming in the early part of this year, 87% of them survived. And even including vegetable growers, which are perishables, they could find partly local markets, but also they linked it with a relief effort in Kerala for the community kitchens.
You are saying the power of the collective is particularly relevant, and we should address that, address the social challenges or economic challenges through the power of the collective.
I think so. You know, also what you're talking about is producing collective assets. So one is the power of the collective in terms of people coming together privately and being able to having more bargaining power with state and markets that we've talked about, you know, in multiple contexts. But here, what I'm talking about is community services. We think of drinking water as a community service. We have panchayat headquarters or you have panchayat, you know, buildings. But do we think of those panchayat buildings as spaces which could actually be used in a more collective way?
In the final analysis, two things are clear. There is despair. The rank of the neo-poor has swelled, no doubt. Worse, inequality too has spiked. But there is hope too. For that, as Beena points out, you have to embrace a new playbook. As they say, when the going gets tough, the tough get going. That's all for today. Thank you for listening. Hope you enjoyed this episode. Do share your feedback and ideas. You can reach me on Twitter at Capital Calculus or on Facebook and Instagram at HT Smartcast. I'll be back next week with a new episode of Capital Calculus. Till then, stay safe.
This was a Mint production brought to you by HT Smartcast.
HT Smartcast.
What do millions of Americans and 3 former U.S. presidents have in common? They all agree that Boll & Branch sheets are the softest, most comfortable sheets in the world. Boll & Branch cotton is rain-fed, pesticide-free, and carries the highest organic certification. That's why it's so soft. Boll & Branch sheets start at just $160. They're $1,000 quality for a fraction of the price. Plus, you can sleep on them for a month, risk-free. That's BOLLandBranch.com. Restrictions may apply. See BollandBranch.com for details.
Imagine earning a degree that prepares you with real skills for the real world. Capella University's programs teach skills relevant to your career, so you can apply what you learn right away. Learn how Capella can make a difference in your life at capella.edu.